This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
So, one of the central struggles at the heart of any religion is obviously how do you get close to or connect with God? And different cultures will have different versions of this. But in this talk, I want to explore this question in Judaism through the prism of the Beit HaMikdash. You all know that there are current disputes about access to the Temple Mount, and as those disputes escalate, it seems to me that there are larger questions that then arise in their wake. Questions about what is the core goal of Judaism, what is the end game, what's the most important thing, and how do you achieve that goal? So if God is at the center, then what's the best way to gain access to that presence? And there are a number of options, right? You could establish sovereignty over the whole land of Israel, every inch of it. You could build a third temple. Question is, would building that temple and reinstituting a sacrificial system, would that be a step forward or a step backward in the quest for God? And do we now live in a time where even doing such a thing would be spiritually counterintuitive? It would be like a regression to a time of more primitive kind of paganism. What about other options to get close? Prayer or study or charity or good works or coming of the Messiah or moral perfection of yourself? All of it, some of it. In other words, what's the end of history from a Jewish perspective? Or put another way, what do we think that God wants from us? So let's start with the temple. There's a story about the 16th century writer, Spanish writer and theologian, Friar Luis de León. And Luis de León was a very interesting character. He was arrested by the Inquisition, actually for having translated Shira Shirim into Spanish. He was put in jail for 5 years. And he had a very dry, sardonic sense of humor. And when he was released from prison, he was the chair of theology at the University of Salamanca. And when he was released and he went back to the classroom, his opening words in his first lecture after 5 years was, "As I was saying yesterday." So maybe it's that simple with regard to the temple as well. We suffered catastrophe. The two temples were destroyed. And maybe the best route to God is back to the future. You treat 2016 like it was yesterday. 2,000 years just a mere interlude. And you rebuild a temple and you return to where we were when the Romans so rudely interrupted Jewish history. And that seems to be what some of our texts want. If you look at the source number one, right, this is our liturgy from the Amidah. We say it every day. The Ritzei prayer, right? Ritzei Hashem, Elokeinu Melech Chai Yisrael Tefillah Latam, like pay attention, take seriously our prayer. Hasheva to Avodla Livri Betecha, right? Return the service to the house, right? And sacrifices and on and on. And then at the end, after you've already taken 3 steps back, you ask that may it be God's will that the temple will be rebuilt. Doesn't say who'll rebuild it, but that it should be rebuilt. So it would seem like that's maybe something that we want. In source number 3, you get something similar, which is this notion that the temple is what you need for atonement. This is a pasuk in Parshat Achrei Mot. Ki nefesh habasar badam hi, right? That the soul of the flesh or the life of the flesh is in the blood. Vanu netativ lachem al mizbeach. I've given it to you on the altar. L'chaper al nafshotechem. To make atonement for your souls. Ki adam hu banefesh chaper, right? It's through the blood that you'll gain atonement for your life or your soul. And Rashi points out, so it's a substitute. One soul, the blood of the sacrifice, will atone for another soul, meaning you, right? So you'd think, okay, that's really the way. You know, we had it, we lost it, but truth be told, that's the way, best way, most visceral way to get back to God. But already in later biblical writing, you see in source 4, biblical writers began to question whether korbanot have become a kind of abused and corrupt process, no longer meaningful in any way to God. Look at what, I mean, we have stuff here from Yirmiyahu and also Yeshaya, right? If you look in the first paragraph of Yeshaya, right, where he says, very sort of provocatively, like lamali, right? What do I need this for? Lamali rov zivchechem yomar Hashem savati olot elim v'chelev meriim v'dam parim kvasim v'atudim lo chafatzti. Like, what point is this? What purpose is all this sacrifice? I'm like sick of. I'm full of like these offerings that you give me. I don't have any pleasure in these rams and these goats and so on, right? So you would think, oh, does that mean sacrifice has outlived itself? That's a real question, right? There's a certain ambiguity here that's important, right? Is it that the Navi is saying this is no longer useful to God? It's had its day, it's passed. Or is it just saying, I don't mind that you bring sacrifices, but doing it in the absence of any kind of moral accountability, any kind of ethics, doesn't work. So you need both for them to work, but it's not one substituting for the other. So that's a question that we have to think about. It is also true that later in that passage, God says the same thing about prayer. It's not just sacrifice. It's like, what do I need your tefillot also, right? So lest we think that one is more primitive and the other isn't, it's worth seeing that maybe all of these methods of getting close to God are bankrupt in the absence of some kind of moral accountability. Now, the rabbis of the Talmud, they don't have the luxury of just waiting and yearning for the coming of the next Beit HaMikdash. They have to do something. They have to think in the present moment and offer Am Yisrael a way of feeling empowered and feeling that atonement for sin was possible, that a relationship was still possible, and could be achieved regardless of historical circumstances. So something very interesting happens, and I want us to take a look together at the next six or seven sources in rabbinic writing. Right, all of these are alternatives to sacrifice as a means of reaching God. And not only are these seen as feasible alternatives, but often the rhetoric in the rabbis is the fact that the substitutes may be better than the original. So, for instance, we'll just do a sample here, right, in number 5. In Avot Rabbi Natan, when Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai and his student Rabbi Yeshua are leaving Yerushalayim and they're looking back at the destroyed temple, and Rabbi Yeshua is grief-stricken, he's devastated, you know, the place where he used to get kapara, it's gone, and Rabbi Yochanan says to him, don't worry, we have one atonement equal to it, it is charity, and he quotes a pasuk. So you have to ask yourself in these sources, there are many like this. Is the rhetoric of the source there to say, we really believe this? In other words, I believe what I'm saying. This is as good as that. Or is it a way, bidiyavad, to say, look, this is a disastrous situation. I have to sort of say something to rally the troops. So I'm going to tell you that this is as good as that. But in my heart of hearts, I don't really think it's as good as that. So that's a question that the reader really comes upon again and again and again. And it's a crucial question because if he really means it, in other words, if these post-temple forms of accessing God and replacing the temple are just as legitimate or even better, then it suggests a movement forward in history without looking back. In other words, you don't want to go back. This is even better. It could be that it was created by circumstance, but now that it's here, we're actually doing a lot better spiritually, we're progressing and so on. So there has to be a sense of how do we read those passages. And again, we see the same thing. So, for instance, in source number 6, Hustai ben Yanai, who's comparing God to human beings, and says, you know, when a person brings a gift to a king, he doesn't know whether it'll be accepted. He doesn't even know if he'll get to see the king. But a Kadosh Baruch Hu's not like that. If you give a penny to a pauper, you get schar, you experience the Shekhinah. So charity will get you where you need to go. Number 7, another option, which is personal suffering, affliction. Just as sacrifices are means of atonement, so too are afflictions. And he now ups the ante. He says, an affliction atones even more than korbanot. For korbanot affect only your money, but afflictions affect the body, so it's actually better. And then the one that everybody knows in number 8, which is the idea of prayer replacing sacrifice in the Gemara and Brachot, Rabbi Yeshua ben Levi Amar, it's number 8. Tfilot keneged tmidin tiknu, right? That God instituted prayer, that the sages institute prayer in place of sacrifice. Okay, so if you look on the next page,
this continues. Gemara Brachot, Reb Sheshet had fasted.
So far we have suffering, we have charity, we have prayer.
And now we get fasting, number 9. When Reb Sheshet kept a fast, he concluded his prayer with, "Master of the universe, you know full well that in the time the temple was standing, person sinned, he brought a korban, and through all that was offered of it was its fat and blood, atonement was made. Now I've kept a fast, and my fat and blood have diminished." I guess, a little weight loss there for 24 hours. "May it be your will to account my fat and blood, which have been diminished, as if I had offered them before you on the altar." You know, who needs a korban when I'm losing weight? You know, it's good enough, right? Number 10, famous Mishnah at the end of Yoma, Rabbi Akiva says, "Happy are you, Israel, who is it before whom you become pure? And who is it that purifies you? Your Father in heaven," right? That's actually the most poignant one of all, because that's the one that doesn't use any props. Not charity, not prayer, not fasting, not studying, nothing, just you. Just your own sense of standing before God, asking for atonement, and getting it, which is essentially the model that we now have. So all of this suggesting myriad of alternatives to what was lost. And of course there's study, which is referred to by Dr. Epstein here in number 11, where he says that there were two motives that kept alive the study of Sefer Kodshim even after the laws had fallen into disuse. You have to think to yourself, like, why am I still studying, you know, Masechet Zvachim and Menachot and so on? So he says, well, one sprang from the unquenchable host that the Beit HaMikdash would sooner or later be rebuilt. In other words, they're hoping this is going to be temporary. But then he says something very interesting. He says the other was the belief that the study of the laws could serve as a surrogate and was no less efficacious than the actual offering of the sacrifice itself. So you don't need to do the sacrifice, you just need to learn about them, and that's good enough. So you have all of these alternatives, all of which have a basis in Jewish tradition. But in doing that, which was brilliant, they actually unleashed a dilemma that we still face, right? Which is, are these alternatives, prayer, fasting, Torah study, charity, and so on, are these merely substitutes for the real center of things, which is the Beit HaMikdash? Or do these alternatives themselves become the center? Which means, ironically, that if we built a Beit HaMikdash today, it would actually be a weakened substitute for the substitute. Right. So is prayer just a stand-in for the sacrifices? Is it a move up? Would sacrifice be a step back? So I look at this as a kind of a semiotic problem. Like, what is the thing and what is the substitute? Now, if you go back to the first page, look at source number 2. Here's the French philosopher Jacques Derrida. And Derrida says the following. "The entire history of the concept of structure must be thought of as a series of substitutions of center for center." So I want to spend a few moments discussing this. When you have a sign of something, that sign by definition is always unanchored because it can always be replaced. It's shiftable. Once you say something is a sign of something else, then it could always be displaced. If I have a boarding pass on paper, it's a sign of me going onto that plane. But I could throw it out, and I could get out my smartphone, and that would also be a sign of me. And maybe in the future, won't have to do that either. Once something is not the thing itself, but the sign of the thing, it can always get tossed, all the time. So a sign has no innate or transcendental truth. And that's the problem with all religion, is do we have the right signs? So if we had an analogy, right? Let's say somebody really important to you suddenly goes away or even disappears. And you want to figure out the best way of keeping them in mind. So imagine this happened to you. So you take out letters they once wrote to you, and you read them, but the ink or the type on the paper doesn't satisfy you. So now you dig out an old picture, but that also seems two-dimensional. Maybe you have a phone recording or a video recording, and maybe that'll satisfy you, maybe it won't, but what it'll remind you of is that it's in the past. It's not, they're not here in real time. So then you think about something else. You think about some night you spent together that was the best night of your whole life. And perhaps actually thinking about that night, not with any other kind of signs, just in your head, thinking about that night is the closest you're ever going to feel about them. So you do that for a while, and then you get crazy, and you go back to the letter, and then back to the photo, and back to the recording, right? And the cycle begins all over again. So at any given moment, one of these signs seems like the real thing to you. This is the closest access I'm going to get to the reference, my beloved. And yet, each time you do it, you realize instantly it could be displaced by some other sign. And then another and another and another, and it keeps coming back. And that's what Derrida calls the free play of the sign. Nothing stays in place. Because the origin, the center is absent. And once the center is absent, you just keep substituting signs, trying to get at it, and so on. And then, ultimately, you have to ask yourself, do you know which sign is really the best? And that's what we have in Judaism. Which sign is the best? And on some level, this debate about what's the authentic sign and what's the substitute underlies the medieval argument about korbanot, which we're going to look at now in source number 12. Right. You know, so Maimonides famously historicizes the role of korbanot in his comments in source 12. He says, at the time of the Exodus, the way of life generally accepted and customary in the whole world and the universal service upon which we were brought up in Egypt consisted in offering various species of living beings in the temples in which images were set up, in worshiping the latter, and in burning incense before them. For one could not then conceive the acceptance of a law without korbanot, considering the nature of man, which always likes that to which it is accustomed. At that time, telling them no more sacrifices would have been similar to the appearance of a prophet in these times, our times, who, calling upon the people to worship God, would say, God has given you a law forbidding you to pray to him, to fast, or to call upon him for help in misfortune. Your worship should consist solely in meditation without any actions. Just before we go on, I want to commend you to think about your local Beit Knesset sitting in absolute silence for 5 minutes, not forget about 2 hours, and that's what he's talking about here. Would we be capable of such a thing? But he's saying, like, if somebody came along and said, no more talking, no more praying, no more Kriyat Torah, no more this ritual stuff, none of that, out the window, that's not how you service me. So the Rambam believes that if God had told the Jewish people at that point, no more korbanot, just wouldn't have gone down to continue. Therefore, God suffered these kinds of worship to remain, but transferred them from created or imaginary things to his own name. If you're going to sacrifice, don't sacrifice to the other God, sacrifice to me. Commanded us to build a temple, have an altar, have sacrifice, bow down and worship, burn incense. Through this divine ruse, right? Interesting word. Trick. It came about that the memory of idolatry was effaced and the true foundation of our belief, namely the existence and oneness of the deity, was firmly established. At the same time, the Jews had no feeling of repugnance and were not repelled because of the absence of modes of worship to which they were accustomed. So it's a little sleight of hand there, right? God wants them to stop worshiping idols, realizes that if he just says no more sacrifice, it won't work. So he says, okay, you know, you can keep on sacrificing, but we're going to make some alterations. Got to be in one place, my altar, towards me, and so on. So it's obviously a very controversial idea because it explicitly argues for sacrifices as an inferior mode of worship. It's a concession to the mindset of people who can't tolerate a change in their religious behavior. So, and Maimonides makes it clear that all cultures are resistant to religious change. His culture, our culture, all cultures. tell them we're going to do it differently, that's a problem. This is called the theory of divine accommodation, right? God, so to speak, accommodates the inbuilt prejudices and habits of those to whom he's giving the Torah, and that leaves many questions, which we're not going to get into here, about the potentially temporary nature of the Torah itself. In other words, would it say something completely different if it was given in 2016, given that the way we think about spirituality is not about animal sacrifice? Naturally, there was pushback. The most famous criticism came from the Ramban in Source 13. The Ramban, as one of my students once said, the Ramban is pissed. And he really is very upset. And he said, far be it that they, meaning the laws of sacrifice, should have no other purpose and intention except the elimination of idolatrous opinions from the minds of fools. Now he begins to give his proofs. The Torah says plainly that korbanot are for a reach nichoach, for a pleasing odor. A person should realize he has sinned against his God with his body and soul, and that his blood should really be spilled and his body burned, so that its blood should be in place of his blood. Now he gives another proof. When Noah came out of the ark with his three sons, there were as yet no Chaldeans or Egyptians in the world, yet they brought an offering pleasing to God, and likewise brought of the firstborn Hevel, right? Abel. Brought of the firstborn of his flock and the fat, yet at that time there was yet not the slightest trace of idol worship in the world. So it's a very logical denunciation. First, the Torah repeatedly refers to korbanot, right, as reach nichoach ishel Hashem, offering by fire, pleasing odor to God. Now, granted, it's very hard to fathom why God needs a pleasing odor, but the Ramban is arguing that if Maimonides is right, this is really strange, right? This anthropomorphic image of divine gratification that you get would seem superfluous if it's a ritual that God doesn't want in the first place. Like, why build it up like that if you don't really want it? And he has a historical challenge, which is that long before idol worshippers enter the world, right back at the beginning of recorded history in the Bible, people are bringing sacrifices and God seems happy with them. So, this goes back and forth. But for Maimonides, who never backs down, he is convinced that there's a primary intention in Source 14 and a secondary intention of the law. And the primary intention is to get rid of idolatry, and if this is how we need to do it, then that's how we'll do it. And the way we do it is secondary. It's irrelevant. All right, so philosophically, this raises a huge issue, which is whether what the Torah is really going after is to mold certain kinds of attitudes, and the way you do it, the means with which you do it, is kind of secondary or historically conditioned or can change through time. We just want something correct happening in your head and your heart, and the potential for revolution and anarchy in this is self-evident. But Professor Benor, in Source 15, raises what I think is a very good point. We, of course, looking back on all of this, have somewhat, perhaps, some of us have somewhat of a, you know, better than thou attitude. And our feeling is, you know, sacrifices are primitive, prayer is so much more sophisticated, so much more exalted. So Ehud Ben-Or, in his book on Maimonidean prayer, offers the following. He says the comparison of sacrifices to prayer and meditation does not necessarily imply that one practice supersedes the other. The comparison can only imply supersession if we assume that it is possible for human beings to contemplate God. But if God is unknowable, if the divine essence is inconceivable, then the case for meditation will be just as difficult to defend. Maimonides, you know, in the guide, just philosophizes himself right into a corner because he makes such a good, emphatic, convincing case for divine unknowability that it also leaves open the question of, if God is unknowable, then why is one sign superior to the other? Why is one method superior to the other? rationally, people tend to favor non-corporeal ways of worshiping God over corporeal because they see it as more enlightened, more sophisticated, more mental, right? But I don't know. I mean, that's my gut feeling too, but I don't know. How can we know which sign replaces the other? And again, we get to that Derridian sign system where you don't have a sign and a referent, you just have a sign leading to another sign. It just keeps playing around and around. And to complicate matters, of course, and to finish off this section in source 16, Maimonides faithfully codifies all the laws of sacrifice in Hilchot Melachim. Of course, he does it with a bit of a proviso, which is all this will take place with the Messianic coming, as he says, HaMelech HaMashiach atid la'amod lachsir malchut beit David liyoshna haMemshala Rishona, that in the future the King Messiah will come and he'll restore the house of David to its original state and state of sovereignty, Bonem Mikdash, he'll build a temple, Mevechetz Nitche Yisrael, he'll gather the ingathering of the exiles of Israel, Chozrin Kol Mishpatim B'Yamav Kishayu Mikodem, he'll reinstitute all the laws like they were originally, Makrivin Korbanot, and people will come and offer sacrifice, but only in the Messianic realm. And who knows if that realm will ever come. But the Messianic coming raises very tantalizing possibilities about the perfect sign of redemption, right? So some people are hedging their bets. It's like waiting for Godot in the religious world. I don't care about any of this stuff. I'm waiting for the real thing, right? So prayer's nice and study's nice and all this stuff, but we all know that the real sign of the redemption is when the Messiah comes. And that is very interesting to me, because one of the fascinating things about Messianism is the sense of impatience that perpetually accompanies it. Jews have a lot to do, right, in their daily religious lives. There are a lot of mitzvot that keep us busy morning till night, all year long, and doing these mitzvot is ostensibly the route to a fulfilled life and a fulfilled afterlife, and yet somehow that fantasy of speeding it up, right, and getting past the daily grind, like the shortcut to salvation, that's a big temptation, especially in times of distress or misfortune. You do see, and we're not going to talk about this at length, but you do see a pattern in Jewish history that's been often commented upon, that after great, great trauma, there's often a kind of messianic fervor, false messiahs arise. Now, I wonder sometimes if that is the condition of the world now, right? Where the temptation to make a shortcut is really, really ever present, because of the way people think about the world now. I ran across a piece in The Economist, not just Jews, how all people feel. Look at the rhetoric of this piece in 17. Although wealth has been soaring over the past half century, happiness measured by national surveys has hardly budged. People fear that mankind is failing to manage it properly, with the result that in important ways their children may not be better off than they are. The forests are disappearing. The ice is melting, social bonds are crumbling, privacy is eroding, life is becoming a dismal slog in an ugly world. That's why I love to read The Economist. So, you know, in its wake, you really have this temptation of that better life, the get out of jail free card, the one-stop redemption. But what does it mean, and I have this as an open question, what does it mean to live a life where the most important spiritual feature of that life may never come, may always be theoretical? How can you live that way? Is the Messiah the true sign, that signifier we've been looking for, the best one of all? How can something be a sign in real terms if it doesn't yet exist, if it's always just ahead? And how would you recognize that sign anyway? So if you look at Gershom Scholem in 18, who thought about this very deeply, and the Messiah really is the most poignant symbol in Judaism of a reality that might be there, might be coming, and yet might not, and it leads to a very complex set of emotions for Jews. And Scholem writes the following. In 18, He says the magnitude of the messianic idea corresponds to the endless powerlessness in Jewish history during all the centuries of exile, when it was unprepared to come forward onto the plane of world history. There's something preliminary, something provisional about Jewish history, hence its inability to give itself of itself entirely. For the messianic idea is not only consolation and hope. Every attempt to realize it tears open the abysses which lead each of its manifestations ad absurdum. That was a good line. There's something grand about living in hope, but at the same time, there's something profoundly unreal about it. If you spend all of your time, mental and physical, thinking about what's not in front of you, but what might happen, there's something that's the most real thing to you ever in your head, and yet the most unreal thing in real life. Think about people who never establish some sort of commitment to one another because they just keep waiting. Because somewhere ahead, that messianic romantic partner will be there 5, 10, 25 years in the future, and you can always keep hoping for it, but then it's never actually there. And then what is the life that we live? So Shalom says, thus in Judaism, the messianic idea has compelled a life lived in deferment, in which nothing can be done definitively, nothing can be irrevocably accomplished. Let's stay on that for just a second. I'm not sure he's completely right here. In other words, it has a beautiful flourish to it, and it's right in a certain way that Jews throughout history did live a life filled with deferment because they were living in exile. They were living under often very harsh conditions. But it's not like they weren't living at all, right? They did have lives they lived and mitzvot they did and communities they built and so on. But what he's getting at is that on some, you know, winning the lottery, big ticket, end of the line, salvation kind of rhetoric, the one that obviously Christians imbue all the time by talking about the coming of Christ to earth, dying for your sins, that's like the big ticket. I've told my family this, you know, I taught in university in Canada, we were going over in my class one day, we were going over Jewish conceptions of the Messiah. And in university, you have diverse students from all sorts of religious backgrounds, and the Christians would say to me, why do you Jews work so hard? Right? In other words, like, why do you make it so hard on yourselves? You pray to this invisible God, and you do all this stuff, and even after the end of all of that, there's, like, nothing there? Like, God hasn't come into your life, salvation isn't there, you would think there'd be a big payoff for all of that work. They were genuinely perplexed at the entire modality of Jewish spirituality. Like, what are you doing here? We go to church, we believe we're saved already, we know that Christ has come, etc. So, look, it wasn't my place, I wasn't going to get into a whole theological debate with them, what do Jews think, and, you know, Jesus and so on, but it obviously left an impact on me because I've thought about it ever since, and there's something, and I see the temptation. I really do. So, the Messiah has that tantalizing, that sort of what he calls anti-existentialist. It's not about the here and now. It's like what could be. And he concludes, let's finish it off. So now what happens is that temptation now finds a ground to play itself out. And that ground is actually Zionism, right? Where the temptation no longer has to be deferred because now you've got sovereignty back. And so now maybe we can kickstart messianism a little further. And I'm going to return to that in a few minutes. He says, little wonder that overtones of messianism have accompanied the modern Jewish readiness for irrevocable action in the concrete realm when it set out on the utopian return to Zion. It is a readiness which no longer allows itself to be fed on hopes. Enough of this waiting, enough of this hoping. Born out of the horror and destruction that was Jewish history in our generation, it's bound to history and not to meta-history. See what he's saying here? We're no longer hoping. It's no longer meta-history. We're not floating above hoping. We're in it right now. It's happening in real time. We live in the land, right? Just walk, right? Half an hour, there we are, right? The hot center of the spiritual universe, right? So whether or not, he says, Jewish history will be able to endure this entry into the concrete realm without perishing in the crisis of the messianic claim, which has virtually been conjured up, that is the question which out of his great and dangerous past the Jew of this age poses to his present and to his future. That sentence could be right in the newspaper right now, because what Shalom is saying is whether we can survive actually entering the real land and real history and not do something, in his opinion, dangerous or foolish because of the messianic temptation. That's the great question, right? He wrote this in 1959. Right, even though the book was published in 71, the original essay is 1959. So, you know, almost 60 years ago, he's worried about what Zionism might bring eventually in terms of people wanting that shortcut to salvation. So you do have a paradox here, and I think it's actually something that everybody feels acutely all the time, which is that if you think about religion in a kind of daily, I don't want to say mundane, but the daily grind, you don't think about, you know, getting to God. Just think about doing your job and doing your mitzvot and treating other people well and etc. So there's lowered disappointment. I mean, what can really go wrong from that? There's lowered expectation. But at the end of the day, you sort of may be haunted by this feeling of like, okay, but like, what's this all for? You know, I put on my tefillin every morning for 60 years, but like, what's this all for? On the other hand, you up the expectation. It feels exciting, right? We're doing stuff now that's going to bring the redemption, right? Reshit smichat gulatenu, a very interesting phrase if you think about it, right? Because it ups the ante. It says, you know, the stuff you're doing now, this isn't just like the ordinary Jewish stuff. This is like the shortcut. We're getting there now. We're moving to it, whatever it is. But when you do that, so now you've raised expectation. You certainly could raise disappointment if that expectation does not fulfill itself. So you have a choice. You diminish your hope, but maybe you diminish your disappointment. You raise it, and then you wonder, where am I now? That's true, I think, on a daily religious life for Jews, and it's true on a meta-historical level, like right now in this country. How are we thinking about this, right? Let's take just a few minutes before we turn to Zionism to think about that conception of the Messiah, right? Because if it's a life lived where all you do is wait for that being to come, what does that mean? The late Stephen Schwarzschild, a wonderful academic, writes in source number 20, the Messiah not only has not come, but will also never have come. He will always be coming. Right? So he conceptualized the Messiah almost as a state of being where it's always just ahead, but it's not meant to be really coming. So you say to yourself, what's the point of that? And the point would be that the notion of its coming spurs the individual to moral perfection. You're striving now. You're going after it. It's a goal to be reached, and it's not important or even relevant where the quote-unquote it arrives. Right? Even the Rambam, in his own way, in Source 19, tries to lower the temperature greatly, right, when he says, Al yale al alev shibont ha-mashiach yivatel devar mimin hago shel olam. Don't think that it's going to be this like brave new world, right? People will have a little bit more space to serve God and they'll be free from Gentile oppression, but that's the deal, and it's not the shortcut that you might think it is. Hermann Cohen, right, very influenced by Kant, also has something similar and says the Messiah's coming is not an actual end in Source 21, but merely the infinity of his coming, which in turn means the infinity of ethical development, right? The idea of the Messiah is for you to keep on getting better and getting better and getting better. So this is funny, sort of funny. There's this letter that Rosenzweig writes to Benno Jacob, and you can see he's sort of like a little frustrated with all these metaphors. And he says, I have no idea how one should pray for something one holds beforehand is impossible. What's all this Messiah talk if it's not going to come? The eternal, which we Jews mean, lies not in the infinite, but rather, b'mehirah b'yameinu, speedily and in our days. What is not to come save in eternity will not come in all eternity. If you keep pausing this idea as something that's eternal, well, it means it never comes, is what that means. So there is a tension between those who take it seriously, and there's going to be a Messiah, and it's going to come, and it's really going to happen, and those who don't. And there is a strategy, I guess, behind it, right? If you deflate this messianic coming, if you tell people, yeah, okay, it'll come, maybe, but that's not what's important. So what you do is you allow people to live in the present moment without feeling like their entire spiritual life is just a kind of prelude that never gets played out. So there is a logic to it. But you're also lowering the sense of what is possible. And this, I think, ties into, I actually think this is the actual metaphor for the halachic discussion about who will build the temple, right? It's a machloket in Rishonim about who builds the temple, humans or God, right? The Rambam seems to feel like it'll be a person or a community, right? Whether it's the Messiah or others, we have the mitzvah to build the temple. Rashi, in his comment in Gemara and Sukkah in 23, quotes a midrash here that says that the future temple will be completely built and brought down from heaven. Bet you never thought that way, right? Prefab Beit HaMikdash. That's what it is. It's just going to pop down right onto the Har HaBayit, you know. But that machloket is the same, it's the same idea, right? The idea that I will build it is the sense of I could do it at any moment. I could do it now. I could jumpstart history. The idea that God will build it seems much more like a life lived in deferment. I'm not going to think about it. Whenever it happens, it happens. It's not my job. It's not my business. It'll just kind of happen. Emmanuel Levinas, actually very boldly wants to say explicitly that it is not about the physical structure. It is not about the other human being. It is not about waiting for something to happen. It's all about us, all the time, every day. So messianism is eternal because messianism is present. In other words, it is always, every time, every day, every moment. As he writes, one has failed to say anything about the Messiah if one represents him as a person who comes to put a miraculous end to the violence in the world, the injustice and contradictions which destroy humanity but have their source in the nature of humanity. Messianism is not the certainty of a coming of a man who stops history. It is my power to bear the suffering of all. It is the moment when I recognize this power and my universal responsibility, and as he says later on in the sources, the Messiah, c'est moi, it's me, right? Not in some sort of, you know, sociopathic, narcissistic way, but that's what messianism is for Levinas. It's you and me, all the time, every day. Once you take on the face of the other as real, right? In other words, a life beyond me, all the time, and you're willing to bear that, that's what messianism means. And the temple and all the accoutrement, the sacrifices really are not the point at all. They're there to create the consciousness that gets you to this point. However, there is the impatient side. Here's a Chabad's Children rally. Jewish nation, have no fear. Mashiach will be here this year. If we want Mashiach now, we don't want to wait. Okay? If I knew the tune, I'd try and sing it, but I don't, so I don't want to wait. All right. Let's move into the last section here about Zionism. So I'm going to take a minute to summarize. Right. I'm not super interested in the politics that attend to constant newspaper articles about, you know, the Beit HaMikdash and whether to ascend. There's obviously a huge political problem in that there are other, shall we say, residents up there for the moment. And that's not what interests me anyway. What interests me is the impulse to do it. And the impulse to do it, I'm arguing, is part of a whole historical struggle within Judaism to figure out how do we get to it. And I've also argued that getting to it, meaning using things to get to the reference, the origin, the center, God, the idea, the spirit, whatever you want to call it, is always a semiotic act that's filled with trouble. Because every time you represent something, that representation can be displaced. So the question that Jews all over the world all the time, and maybe especially in this country, have to think about is, how do we think about this whole problem of what it means to get to God? What's the best means to do it? Is it physical? Is it literal? Is it now? Is it later? What's my part in it? There's no question that the rhetoric of religious Zionism as it developed definitely intensified the notion that there are ways of actually making it speed up. So let's take a few moments to talk about the concept of holy space and the idea of whether the land of Israel and by extension Yerushalayim and by extension Har HaBayit have a kind of special holiness, and worshiping God there is somehow closer. That geographical proximity is in some way the key to spirituality, the master signifier. And I'm going to share with you something that I'm sure is not politically correct, but I am not a big fan, never have been, I don't think ever will be, about davening at the Kotel. Actually, I find it for myself very, very mibulbal when I go there. I never feel like I have a good prayer experience. I realize that there's an intensity that people identify with the stones, which are, after all, Herod's retaining wall for the Beit HaMikdash, and I don't begrudge anybody their experience there, but there's something troubling to me always about the sense like God is here and not in Pittsburgh or Omaha or wherever you're from. Louis Jacobs once pointed out, Rabbi Dr. Louis Jacobs, that monotheism has a problem with holy space because if God is everywhere, then what are you telling me that he's like here as opposed to here or here or here? What does it mean that one place is more holy? And he offers the two classical answers, which is there are some people who believe that here is magical, that it's actually holy space. It's like somebody, God came to the land of Israel and sprinkled magic dust. And once you cross that border, you land in Ben-Gurion, you get off, you've entered holy land. You don't have to do anything. You've just entered holy land. That's the way Rabbi Yehuda Levi thought about it in the Middle Ages. Professor Menachem Kellner has pointed out that for Halevi, it's almost like if you had a Geiger counter, which measured holiness, and you got off the plane, it would start buzzing, right? Like, here we are. You don't have to do anything. It's just there's holiness here, inherent holiness. The other view in Jewish history is it has nothing to do with what it is. It has to do with what Jews did. If you go to a place and you make it sacred by doing sacred things there, so you're Mekadesh the place. You sanctify the place. So it is inherent, or is it functional? How do we think about holiness? Now, when it comes to the 20th century and Rav Kook, so Rav Kook, Zionism is not just another nationalist movement. The land of Israel is just not another squiggle on the map. In the sign system of Rav Avram Yitzchak Kook, it's part of the key to everything, not just Israel, not just the Jews, not just humanity. It's the key to the cosmos. It's the beginning of the end of history, the Jews coming back to Israel. There's a divine will at work, often in mysterious ways, and the land will get built up, and once it's built up, the final redemption will come. Now look, traditional Judaism also had that idea that if you build up the land and all the Jews return to Israel, that the redemption will come. But the thing is that historically, when people finally returned to the promised land in the 19th and 20th centuries, they didn't return to their God. They just returned to their land. In fact, the pioneers who took action to facilitate it were actually rebelling against God in many ways. So there's an unresolved riddle for religious Zionist thinkers, which is how can you explain the fact that the movement that fulfilled the expectations of generations of Jews simultaneously shattered those same expectations? So if Kook managed to turn this problem on its head by arguing that the Chilonim were not abandoning God, but the reverse, it was all part of an unconscious return to God. And the precedent for this can be found in Source 26 in Hegel. Hegel had this idea called the cunning of reason, in which he writes, human actions in history produce additional results beyond their immediate purpose and attainment, beyond their immediate knowledge and desire. They gratify their own interests, but something more is thereby accomplished, which is latent in the action, though not present in their consciousness and not included in their design. People do stuff, and they think they're doing one thing, and unwittingly, they're bringing about a whole other thing, and they're not even aware of it. That's the cunning of reason. That's history working for its own purposes, almost independently. Hegel saw nations as dynamic organisms. He said there was a kind of living soul that informed a nation, a country. And this invisible spirit and lives and develops through the history of the nation. And Rav Kook obviously drew a parallel between that and what the Kabbalah calls Knesset Yisrael. And so this is what he talks about in Source 27 as developed by Professor Avi Neri. According to Rav Kook, in the divine cosmic order where every detail has its own place and telos, the true meaning of a person's action may be unknown to himself. He may fancy himself as motivated by A, yet the ultimate meaning of his action may be B. The same applies to the Zionist pioneers. They may subjectively think they are motivated by secular political ideas, but truly they are acting within a cosmic scheme of a divine will, in which their seemingly secular and even atheistic motivation is nothing else than an external cover for the true meaning of their action as related to God's redemptive structure. These people may contribute toward the ultimate messianic coming even while they deny it. They have to be seen as tools and vessels in the hands of providence. Unbeknownst to themselves, they serve the labor of the divine. Now, as you can imagine, secular Zionists were not always enamored of this ideological interpretation. I remember reading, there's a book by Amos Oz, In the Land of Israel, a very good book, actually. And he writes, this is in 1982, he writes the following about Rav Kook's followers, quote, "Well, you can adopt a patronizing, insulting interpretation in which the early pioneers thought they were acting from an idealistic worldview, but were really no more than an instrument of God, and that the holy sparks flew out of their secular socialist shell without their intending it. But that is trampling the spiritual autonomy of others and has always made me feel insulted and bitter." He adds, "Zionism was our train," meaning secular. "We owned it, we drove it, we put the religious Zionists in charge of the dining car for kashrut. And for some strange reason, these kashrut servers have gone mad and they've seized the train and they're driving it in a different direction entirely. They have stolen our Zionism." It's interesting that Rav Kook was vehemently opposed to ascending to the Temple Mount. There's actually a poster that you can find, you can even see it online, in his name, saying that it's asur to go up to the Temple Mount. And it wasn't about, for him, it wasn't about the Temple Mount, it was this mystical view of the land. And his son, Rav Tzvi Yehuda, as you see in Source 28, upped the ante and proclaimed that acquiring and expressing sovereignty over the land would precipitate the redemption. He says, "How is it that the movement for concrete redemption in our time, including the settlement and conquest of the land, did not originate with the religious? How is it that some religious spokesmen even withheld their support for Zionism and the movement for redemption? They failed to recognize it was not that we mortals were forcing the end, but rather that the master of the house, the Lord of the universe, was forcing our hand, that it was not human voices that broke down the wall separating us from our land, but the voice of the living God calling upon us to go up. It is not we who are forcing the end, but the end that is forcing us." Okay? So that's a view of interpreting history and interpreting God and putting them together. And what the ultimate signifier for Rav Kook here is that if you take over all the land, if you establish sovereignty over every last inch of that holiness, so you're almost all the way there. It's like redemption's on the other side of that. We just can get to it. It's like you shorten the distance, literally and figuratively. Take over every piece, and at the end, God's on the other side. Has to be, right? That's why, in a certain ideological sense, this has nothing to do with political negotiation or political rationality. The truth is, I assume, that vis-a-vis that ideology, if tomorrow, it's not going to happen, but if tomorrow moderate, peace-loving Palestinians flow out of the West Bank and Gaza, and they come to the Israeli government and they say, we've seen the error of our ways, no more terrorism, land for peace, here's all our guns, here's all our bullets, here's all our bombs, it's never going to happen again. You give us this, we'll give you that. And it was real. Now, obviously, none of this can be verified, but it wouldn't matter. It wouldn't make any difference. In fact, doing that would be a disaster. In some ways, ironically, if the Palestinians were more peace-loving, that would precipitate a huge religious crisis in religious Zionism, because now the ideology would be tested through pragmatics. But instead, you have this notion that every inch is required. Probably familiar, it's a very famous speech that Rav Tzvi Yehuda Cook gave at Merkaz HaRav Yeshiva in May 1967, just a few weeks before the Six-Day War. It was a very tense time in Israel. And what has now become a legend in Dati Lumi circles, he cried out 19 years ago, he's referring to 1948, the establishment of the state. 19 years ago on the night when the news of the UN decision in favor of the reestablishment of the state of Israel reached us, people streamed into the streets to celebrate and rejoice. I could not go out and join in the jubilation. I sat alone and silent. A burden lay upon me. I could not resign myself to what had been done. I could not accept the fact that they have indeed divided my land, a pasuk from Yoel. And now, after 19 years, where is our Hebron? Have we forgotten her? Where is our Shechem, our Yericho? Have we forgotten them? All that lies beyond the Jordan, each and every clod of earth, every region, every hill, every valley, every plot of land that is part of Eretz Israel, have we the right to give up even one grain of the land? On that night, 19 years ago, during those hours, as I sat trembling in every limb of my body, wounded, cut, and torn to pieces, I could not then rejoice. So here the ultimate signifier is the land itself. It's really about settlement. It's worth remembering that settlement had the imprimatur of the secular labor government. I'm not here to talk about the pros and cons of settlement, whether it bring redemption closer, you can draw your own conclusions. What does interest me, though, is the precariousness of making that your sign, right? If that's your sign, if at the other end of getting to every last inch, God's on the other side, but you're hooking that to a country that has a very diverse religious outlook and very diverse views about doing that in the first place, there's really going to be a precariousness there. And that's what happened ideologically in the Hitnatkut in Gush Katif, which is that project came to a screeching halt. I don't mean settlement. I mean the idea of redemption that would come with settlement, right? Micha Goodman writes the following. He says that one example that was experienced by people of self-doubt was this statement by Rabbi Moshe Tsuriel. He says, how can you call this Reshit Smichat Gulatenu, he said after the Hitnatkut. If Rav Kook were in our generation today, would he feel that way? Would he feel that's Reshit Smichat Gulatenu? There was this sense that it's going wrong, right? And maybe that's why some of his followers refused to believe that they were really going to leave Gush Katif. Many rabbis didn't tell their students, says Rabbi Goodman, that a withdrawal must not happen. He said there would not be a withdrawal at all. It's not happening. So they didn't make preparations. They didn't pack up, some of them. They didn't believe the day of evacuation would ever come. And now the deck gets shuffled. And you realize, see, because what was Rev Cook Sr., what was Rev Avram Cook's thesis? It's all happening unwittingly on the backs of the secular Zionists. They're going to be leading us to where we need to go. And that thesis got blown up in 2005 when they turned and said, no, not necessarily. Maybe not. So what do you do now with that signifier? And I guess what I want to say here in closing is that it's possible there are people now hypothesizing there's a straight line between the Hitnatkut and the current fervor to ascend the Temple Mount. In other words, the endless possibility of settlement got a little bit curtailed, and so now the shortcut switches to something else. And that something else might be ascending Har HaBayit. In 29, there's this startling statement, really, I think, by Rav Lau, the Ashkenazi chief rabbi, Semi Haredi, saying he'd like to see the Jewish temple rebuilt. No need to remove any of the Muslim shrines. The very notion that somebody would say that is remarkable, right? Given the steadfast opposition in Haredi circles forever towards any kind of movement up the Temple Mount. And so now you have this fight going on. If you look in sources 30 and 31, there are people who are pushing to go up the Temple Mount. Professor Hill Weiss in 30, I want a temple-based state where the state's entire content revolves around the temple. In the second paragraph there, he says, and I think his rhetoric is interesting, it's just a matter of habit. Some people think redemption has arrived. They do not grasp the absence. The absence is that we do not truly have Judaism. All the prayers are only a substitute for the real thing. The prayers were institutionalized after the temple was destroyed. It's only a memory of something. What about the true Judaism? We are not true Jews. We are only perpetuating something that existed in the past. I see nothing wrong about the temple. I see it as the end of days, right? Perfect articulation of the problem of the sign. Now the substitute comes back, right? In 31, I'll leave for you to read, Tomer Persico talking about after Gush Katif, there was this desire maybe to turn towards the Temple Mount and shortcut redemption. Okay. Now, whether we want sacrifices or not, I guess, depends on your particular sensibility. There was an article on 32 by Shmuley Yanklowitz last year about the idea that this is a move backwards, it's barbaric, we're far beyond that, and so on. That's in 32. Even Rav Kook believed in spiritual evolution in the move forward in 33. Okay, I'm going to close. If God is invisible, ineffable, incorporeable, unknowable, then the question for Jews is how to get there. And we're constantly looking for that sign of the signified. It's a problem to even know what God wants, right? Moshe Halbertal in 36 talks about the fact of what do you bring to God? God has got everything. Like, what present do you bring to God? He actually calls that the problem of the rich spouse. What are you supposed to give this person, you know? Sometimes in religious life, all religions, the feeling that you want to make it go quicker can take a very bad turn. It can make you think that your truth should be everyone's truth, your solution, everyone's solution. That's what Rabbi Sacks is talking about in number 38. And when she says that truth in heaven may be platonic, but man cannot aspire to such truth, and if he does, he'll create conflict, not peace. Men kill because they believe they possess the truth while their opponents are in error. Truth on the ground is multiple, partial, fragments of it lie everywhere. Each person, culture, and language has part of it. None has it all. Truth on earth is not, nor can aspire to be the whole truth. And so on. But if that's not your vision of religion, you end up with what Professor Zizkin talks about at the end, which is religion directs your attention to the absolute, and the more you're focused on the absolute, the more human behavior appears as wanting. And the more human behavior appears as wanting, the more devastating corrective measures will have to be. And we do see that a lot in the present state of the world. I'm happy to take questions. Afterlife is just another form of deferment. It certainly is. I mean, it's sort of part and parcel of that messianic puzzle where it either ends up getting you to not just tamp down your expectations, but actually reinterpret your world, right? So you see something in front of you that seems to have one meaning, and then you throw the afterlife piece in it, and you say, oh, well, it means something else. It's true this person had a horrendous life, and they suffered greatly, but they'll have a good afterlife. So it's actually luring you into a complete reinterpretation of the circumstances in front of you. On the other hand, if it's true, so then it ends up being that ultimate peace. Yeah.
We've always been searching for an endpoint. We always put it in personal terms. It's really very, perhaps a Maimonidean idea. Perhaps the endpoint should be a people practicing righteousness and justice, or perhaps even the whole world and all of God.
I'm not looking for an endpoint for the person or the people. In other words, yeah, obviously Jewishly you have this notion of a collective movement towards tshuva, towards repentance, as a way of inspiring the whole world. The question is, what are the behaviors that you're going to carry out as a people that's going to create those conditions? And more fundamentally, what happens when everybody disagrees about what are the key signifiers here, right? When people say, you know, if we don't do this, this delays the redemption, and you don't have a kind of consensus about that, so that's where things fall apart. Yeah.
Well, just following up with what you said, I just want to let people know that at 2:30, I didn't have to take this announcement.
So could you make it afterwards, and I'll give you right at the end? Okay, thanks. So the question wants to clarify between the shortcut and the long cut. You're right, there is nothing natural in the process of religion. Religion is constructed. Okay, so after the destruction of the Second Temple, there is a kind of revolutionary shift to this day of a democratization of Judaism. It goes out of the temple, out of the priesthood, into the hands of people. Prayer and study became primary modes of how to do this thing called Judaism. I call that the long cut, not out of any kind of sense of disparagement. But what it is that you do this day after day after day after day, and you have a sense vaguely that, A, this is a good thing to do, it's maybe a meaningful life, it maybe leads me to focus ethically on my neighbor, but as centuries pass, and the historical conditions of Jews were horrible in some ways, you begin to ask yourself, okay, I've been doing this stuff, but I'm still suffering. Is there a way where the good times can come faster? Is there a way that God can enter faster? So there are all sorts of metaphors for this, whether you want to call it the Messiah or sovereignty over Israel, whatever it is, people were struggling with to this day, to this moment, trying to figure out, is there some key that can make this all feel somehow a little bit more meta, a little bit more
this is why we do this. This is going somewhere, getting somewhere. Now, for some people, that's the wrong question entirely. The question is just stay patient, do what the Torah asks you to do, and the rest is not your business. But there is, I think, an understandable temptation that human beings feel, that Jews feel, if they carry out any kind of spiritual life, to ask, what's this for? Is it for anything beyond just the fact that this is what Jews do, or we do it together, or we like it? On any given morning on a Shabbat, if you're in Beit Knesset and you're going through what you're going through, or on the high holidays or whatever it is, the thought might arise, like, where's all this going, right? So that's what I call the temptation to the shortcut, right?
About on the on Derrida, the father of postmodernism, and this idea of the structure must be thought of a series of substitutions of center for center. And when I think about Judaism, I think he's wrong. In other words, I think that our center has really not changed. And I mean, this is the whole purpose. I mean, it seems almost ironic to be sitting to Shabbat when we've been mourning the Beit HaMikdash and reading Echa and reading Kinot and singing Yerushalayim, our center has never changed.
Which is what? What is our center? What is our center?
Our center is Jerusalem as the heart of our people. And it seems that everything we've been doing today, and also Yerushalayim, Shabbat Yerushalayim, and the blood churches.
Well, you wouldn't be the first to think Derrida is wrong. There's a long line you can line up with. That Jerusalem is the center of Judaism is, of course, arguable from a lot of points of view, you know. But that's just another, in other words, what is it, for but if I focus on Jerusalem, I focus on it to get somewhere. What Derrida is pointing out is that all of these things are kind of stops or instruments or means to get to what that center really is. And if that center is somehow, and these words are all very vague, God, redemption, the final end, whatever it is. So the question then becomes, what's the best way to get to it? And is it geography, right? That's one of the things that we've been playing with here. Is it having to be here? What's the status of all the other Jews in history who never came to Jerusalem, who could only dream about it? What's the status of people who live in Jerusalem and really don't pay that much attention to the fact that they're living in Jerusalem from any kind of religious point of view, right? All of these ironies well up and need to be answered. And that's why, in the end, if everything is just a way of trying to get to it, those signs can be replaced. They can be displaced because you might have a thought, no, this is not the way. There's a better way. Yeah. Hey, thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.